Okay, this week we're going to talk about George Lucas before Star Wars.
Fanboy Smackdown!
We've got he did a number of things before Star Wars. Two things really of note, and those are THX 1138 and American Graffiti, in that order. There have been he did THX 1138 originally as a student film. I don't know that we necessarily want to talk about that so much.
The student film
the
itself.
The student film. We can touch on it, but as far as what it was a student film.
I think that ultimately, I'm not a film. I don't do films. I don't know anything about it. But watching the student film, I think it was ultimately a technical exercise in what he could do with editing and the appearance of special effects for that time, and creating a believable science fiction world, you know, in 17 minutes.
Right.
Which, it was very effective for what it was. Thin on plot, but it was a good exercise.
And you know, I don't know the specifics of it, and I don't know if it's out there, and I'm sure if it is, somebody will let us know. It could be that's all it was ever intended to be. I mean, I know when I've got an assignment for a class, I do what I need to do to get the grade.
Right.
And, you know, maybe it was.
It won a bunch of awards, though. Fantastic.
Well, there you go.
Film winning awards. His films, they showed a 1 minute montage film that he did in this American Zoetrope feature on the THX director's cut.
All right.
And it was very powerful, just using images to discuss American society at that time in 1 minute. It was very powerful, very interesting. There's a facet of him in terms of how technical he is and how good he is at technical that I think trumps all other directors' abilities in the field of filmmaking. And one thing that I was fascinating about, I've been, you know, so we could talk about this,
sure,
looking up a lot about him, doing some. He was a mechanic when he was in high school. All he ever wanted to do was race cars.
Yeah. Well, and, gee, American Graffiti, man.
Right, right. Well, but what's so amazing is, apparently, you know, he could just listen to your car engine and tell you immediately what was wrong with it. He was always a very technical guy.
Mm-hmm.
And that carried over into his filmmaking, and that carried over into ILM, and that carried over pretty much into everything he's been able to do in terms of revolutionizing the industry, in terms of special effects, how a story is told. It's just really amazing. He's more than a director. And if
right.
you have a problem with him as a director, you're not taking it in terms of the entire person and what he's been able to do for film.
Sure, sure. Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt that he revolutionized film with Star Wars, specifically. With the company that he put together, with the vision he had for it, regardless of, I mean, we talked about Star Wars, we talked it to death.
Right.
But we, you know, to take a look at that, but I think it's interesting to take a look at what came before. We have THX 1138, a very bleak view of the future, very, very, very sci-fi, very, very much in the vein. In the filmmaking, in sci-fi storytelling, it is a known quantity. It's not untread upon ground.
In terms of a dark future where an Orwellian society, it's
absolutely
been done many times.
It has been. I think in filmmaking, in the terms of filmmaking, he broke a lot of ground in showing us a society like that, in the visual representation of it. The white on white is just, it's tough to look at, but that's appropriate.
It's very compelling,
it's,
too.
It's very compelling. It makes everything stand out, which anything untoward, anything different than what should be, stands out. which in terms of the leadership, the upper level of the society is perfect. You know, it's they can very easily see the inconsistencies. Now, I mean, I've just recently touched back on this film. The one thing that I can say for it, and it was very similar to what I said last week about Star Wars, or last time about Star Wars, was that it's got a different pace to it, and this is very typical of movies, you know, from the early mid 70s, late 60s. It's a different pace. The same thing can be said for 2001: A Space Odyssey. It is a slower film. Not that that makes it any better, worse, anything else. It's a different pace. It's just different. I think the one thing it does force a viewer to do is pay a lot closer attention.
Yes.
Which is not a bad thing. It's not bad if you have to watch the movie you're watching. The difference is, you know, and thinking about this in the interim, you've got the difference in the society. When these movies were made, the only venue for seeing a movie was a theater.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe it would get picked up and done something with on television. You didn't have VHS. You definitely didn't have DVD.
And you didn't have internet.
Yeah, there's no internet. There's no way to consume the movie other than going into a theater and being immersed.
And
there's a lot to be said for being immersed in the situation. If you're watching THX 1138 in a theater, you are in that world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you are looking at a white wall, and everything coming out at you is everything that's in your frame of reference. You're watching it at home. You're watching a white spot on the wall with everything else around it. It's harder to watch some of these movies with a different pace on video, on in whatever format, on television, on cable, on VHS, DVD. You know, now we'll have people that are going to argue, well, I've got a big screen TV, all that good stuff. Okay, that makes a bit of a difference, and you do get more of an immersive feel. So you will be able to enjoy those movies more. You're the type of person that is going to be looking for movies like this to consume, to be a part of, because you've created the environment for consuming movies. If the television that you watch Friends on is what you're watching, you know, Star Wars on that same television
is not the same.
On that same 20-inch television is not going to be the same experience. THX 1138 is definitely not going to be the same experience.
I think ultimately you're right, but I think also the pacing at which editing has reached right now,
mm-hmm,
is a reflection of how we disseminate information as people and how much more sophisticated we are at it, and how better we are at putting together postmodern images into one specific train of thought. I would say even for today, as slow as THX 1138 moves, the postmodern montage at the beginning is very challenging to all of your senses, and you're,
yes,
trying to figure out what in the world is going on.
Sure.
The editing today, a lot of stories are told in non-linear fashion. There are a lot of quick cuts. I don't know if that necessarily makes the movies better, more sophisticated. I think it's more adept to the way our mind processes information today,
sure,
being that we are on the internet and we have four windows open and the TV's going on in the background. And
absolutely.
You know, but I don't know if it's necessarily any better.
I would argue films.
I wasn't even alive,
right,
then, and I love them.
I would argue that a film, you know, and jumping topic, you know, which we're going to do, not like we never have the precedent for that happening. A movie like Memento that,
yeah,
is told backwards, you have to pay attention to that movie. a movie like Pulp Fiction, which is told nonlinear. You have to watch. You have to pay attention. You can't. The first time you're consuming these films, you cannot be in an internet chat room with the film with the movie on over your shoulder. It is not possible. You can't do it. You won't get anything out of it.
Right.
By the same token, there are a lot of movies that come out today that you can do just that and not really miss anything.
Yeah, that's
you
true.
You know, they. You know, some of the fight sequence in the Matrix, I know that I could write a short story in the time that that during one fight sequence, for better or worse, you know, and not really feel like I've missed anything in the story.
Right.
Not the case with these films. They you have to pay attention to them. You have to watch what's going on. It's a difference in storytelling. You're actually telling a story through the whole thing. You're not wasting film to further a story. In the terms of writing a story, it's an efficient way of storytelling. You're not wasting film. You're not wasting film on things that don't advance the story. And I think in that respect, it's very positive that these movies were slower paced. You really had to focus on them. You had to pay attention.
I think the same goes for American Graffiti.
Absolutely for American Graffiti. We haven't got into that yet.
And I also think anybody who feels that Lucas, once again, I'm a relentless apologist for his directing, apparently. Mm-hmm. But anyone who feels he's not a good director or can't tell a story,
they just suck.
No. Well. American Graffiti, anyone who's seen an American Graffiti, and what's so amazing is I wonder how many people who are critics of the Star Wars films have seen American Graffiti in the same breath and put together that it's the same director, because it's a very different film from everything else. THX even has more to do with Star Wars, I would argue, than American Graffiti does. And granted, American Graffiti was perhaps more commercial than Lucas wanted to be, and Lucas felt he had to write it, because he lost all of his currency in the industry after THX 1138. But it's a great film.
Yes.
It's a fantastic movie. It's very entertaining. And it's unlike other films of its type, Grease and all those really cheesy movies, American Graffiti feels like it's a real...
It's a very mature story.
Yeah.
It is a very mature
story. And it's a real postcard from that era. And all the details are very precise. And I just enjoyed the hell out of it. I really did.
One thing that is interesting about American Graffiti, it's the type of movie you don't see too much right now. It's a slice of life.
Yeah.
There are stories involved in it, but it takes a while to get to those stories. He does a really interesting. He really takes an interesting take in that he establishes the world. He establishes the world. You know, to say, I mean, he does the same thing in THX. He lays out the groundwork before he gets into what the story is. An audience, someone today watching that movie, if they're used to watching things like Star Wars and The Matrix and, you know, they're going to watch some of these movies if they don't have the patience for it, and in the first 20 minutes saying, what the hell's going on? I don't understand this. I don't understand what these people are doing, and I don't know what's going on.
Right.
By that token, I found myself, when I was watching American Graffiti, saying those same things. And then I had to stop and think about it. This is different. This is a different way of storytelling. This is the way of storytelling, of actually telling
a story.
A story.
It's amazing.
And not forcing a plot down your throat.
Right.
You're giving us characters. You're telling us who these characters are. You're letting these characters become real in our mind, and then you introduce their plots.
You're introducing
the character's journey, and they're all very different journeys.
They all end up in the same places. They don't really do any physical traveling of any kind, except, I mean, unless you count being stationary in a hot rod traveling.
Which, right.
For the purposes of plot, I would say no.
Right.
All they really do is go through changes in their lives, in their minds,
yes,
about how they perceive the world, and they all mature by the end of the picture in one way or another. Yeah,
yeah, it's a really a good solid character study. Richard Dreyfuss's character is about to go off to school. Let's go ahead and preface the story a little bit. We may have people who are unfamiliar with the story. I watched the movie again specifically, you know, before we were going to do this. I knew we were going to talk about George Lucas. I had seen the movie before. I had seen a lot of it in bits and pieces on the local independent television station in the 80s and 90s, Saturday afternoon, you know, 2 o'clock in the afternoon, nothing else going on, take a nap on the couch kind of movie watching.
Right.
And, you know, I didn't really remember all of it. I didn't really remember where it all went. And I watched it cold the other night for probably the first time in 15 years. And the one thing that struck me about it was the pace, a very different pace. And the plots were not epic. The plots were not sweeping. They were not earth-shattering, world-changing stories. But these stories changed the lives of these people. It didn't involve the world blowing up. Nobody.
But for them, it did. I mean, in the
their world,
their
changed.
Lives. You know, and it's so typical of just teenagers, man. I mean, and how I remember, you know, the Ron Howard's character.
Dude, a look from a girl could change your whole life.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
it was
for good or ill. For good or ill. And they showed that. Richard Dreyfuss' character, when he sees the girl in the white car. You know, was it White T-Bird?
Thunderbird, yeah.
The White T-Bird. You know, and that was his quest. That was his grail.
And that was his last quest as a child.
It was his last quest as a child.
In terms of the plot.
This is a very mythic story in a lot of ways. In a lot of ways, it's a very mythic story. Everything's laid out for you at the beginning. You know, you have characters that could make a decision at the beginning of the story, one decision, and the story does not take place at all. Their life has changed, the story does not take place. In the end, they make the other decision. In the beginning, they make the other decision, but ending up coming around full circle to make the decision they could have made at the beginning.
Right.
It's all right back to where it started. It's a very mythic idea in storytelling. That's very common in myth. What you've got with this character, though, is he's getting ready to go off to college. But he sees all of his friends around him are staying. He's not really sure if that's what he wants. He's not sure if that's the path his life should take. You've got, you know, other characters that are surrounding him. You've got the guy that's been out of school for a few years. He's Mr. Cool. You know, everybody knows his name. He's the man who runs the strip. He is the idol.
You're talking about John Milner.
Yes.
The guy with the fastest rod.
Yeah, he's got the fastest rod. He's the man. He's the one.
And he gets stuck with
the 14-year-old.
Which is classic. It's hilarious.
He gets put into a situation that at times gets a little bit creepy,
right?
Because it's like, dude, I don't want to be stuck with the 14-year-old, you know? And it really changes his perspective, though. It makes him take a look at who he really is and realize he's not as cool as he thinks he is,
right?
And you see glimpses of that at the beginning, and he actually says, you know, I'm not going anywhere. I'm not doing anything, you know. He's the king of nobody.
Nothing. Yeah.
Yeah. But man, he runs that world.
Yeah.
You know, and you've got Ron Howard's character who's getting ready to go to school. He makes a fatal flaw. He makes a big mistake. And he thinks he's being cool about it. You know, he goes to his girlfriend. And you see this happening, and you just know, you know it's coming out of his mouth. You know that it's like, dude, shut up. Just don't say it. And he says, hey, we're going to go away to school. We're going to see other people. you know, I think it would strengthen our relationship if we see other people. It's like, shut up.
Yeah.
You know? And to a teenager, though, there's a certain amount of this logic that I guess makes sense. You know,
they don't know what they
and
want.
I don't think he's even thinking that. I think he just thinks he's getting one over on her. Because I think my impression of the situation was...
Oh, he's definitely not thinking about strengthening his relationship.
No. He's thinking about...
What
the fun he's going to have
but
at school.
I don't think it's as sinister as he's trying to, like, trick her or anything. I think he wants out, and that's the best way he can put it. I think that we need to put this to an end.
Maybe that's it, but I think it's also as much as he wants his cake...
Right.
And he wants some more cake back
home. Right. Yeah, I think you're right about
that. With icing on it all.
Because he does say, oh, we'll dance in December.
We'll be right back here.
Yeah.
It's just like, dude, what? You know, you've burned that bridge, you know? What was really refreshing about her as a character was she was a very mature teenage female character, and it was
smarter than the rest of them, really, throughout the film.
Oh, absolutely. She was much more world savvy than, you know, and you could see that he thought he was just being so slick coming up with this idea, and she's like, all right, fine. And she knew that she was just gonna mess with him from then on. You can see the look in her eye. She's like, all right, if that's the way you want it, we'll play it that way. I mean, enough about the story per se. Great film. Definitely worth watching. One thing that I found very interesting about it, and it's another thing you don't see very often, the film ends. You see the skyline in the background, and you get the little snippets of what they're doing now.
Right.
I'm not going to say anything. Don't want it to ruin it for anybody. Right. But it's something you don't see often. Personally... As a movie consumer, I'm not sure whether I like it. I'm not sure whether I needed to know that. It was nice knowing some of it. It was nice seeing how some of the stories advanced. Again,
I think it was very important.
It's also a product of its time. You don't see that kind of thing a whole lot in drama.
But that's
anymore.
That's not what...
You see a lot of it in comedy.
The whole purpose of those snippets at the end, without revealing them, is that the era was gone.
It really did. You know what? I'm gonna take that back. For this film, I do think it did make a difference.
It totally changed the way you perceived the film, because it basically said, here's this whole nostalgic montage of characters that we're going to give you. And then at the end it says, and you know what? That's over. And you're never going to get it back. And it kind of happens quick, and it kind of makes you say, you kind of, whoa, I didn't expect that. It kind of brings you back to reality. Well, in a way that's kind of, oh, you know, wow, you know what? Why can't we have that back? But we can't because of the way the real world works and how it evolved. And I thought it was a... I didn't know if I liked the ending the way it ended.
Right.
You know? But I must say that it definitely changed how I perceived the whole movie up to that point. And I sat there and had to think about what that meant.
Sure.
You know, against the rest of the film.
Absolutely.
And I thought in that way it was very effective.
And I think that another thing that those little... text snippets did on the end of this at the end of the film was you had characters that you had a pretty at the beginning of the film you had a pretty good idea of where they were going. You had a pretty clear understanding of what paths their lives were going to take. Some of them much more clearly defined than others. Some of them could have gone a couple of different ways depending on how the course of the movie went. I think what that showed at the end of the film was there was still a moment at the end of that film of there's more story here.
Right.
You know, did they make the change in their lives that this night showed them that they could make? And the thing about those snippets were is you saw one by one who made those changes and who stayed status quo.
Right.
Who didn't change. Who could have really evolved so much more.
And what I think is interesting about those four is they are all different and they all serve a precise version of change. One guy does not change and he becomes the victim of not changing.
Yes.
One guy does change but still becomes a victim.
Yes.
One guy does not change and lives out his life and you know, nothing changes, but was that good or bad?
Exactly.
Did he ultimately not live because he didn't change anything?
Right.
And then one guy makes the change and comes out different and better. And so out of those four, you only have one guy that really comes out on top in terms of the changes that he did or did not make.
Well, and I would argue that you had two that come out on top. One, just the ending wouldn't be quite the way you would have it end.
Right.
But it was definitely, the change in his life was definitely a positive change to a point.
Yeah, in terms of his character.
In terms of the character.
But he still becomes a victim.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it was a victim of the time.
And that's a sobering, a sobering revelation.
Yeah, especially for that character.
Yeah.
I mean, you know,
you're watching this film and all the characters are ultimately pretty sweet. You know, you like them all.
Yeah.
And then
there's one that, you know, you kind of wish he'd, but he does. He gets smacked. Not physically, but he gets put in his place. And that's the Ron Howard character.
Yeah.
The first couple of times
you don't really dislike him, you just kind of think he's kind of a, oh, what a bum.
He's kind of a weasel.
Yeah, yeah.
He is kind of a weasel.
Yeah.
You know, he's, like I said, he wants to screw around on his girlfriend, but have her waiting at home, not screwing around. And so you get the effect that he's kind of a weasel, which is a very interesting turn for little Ronnie Howard.
Right.
You know, it's not a... The first scene you're seeing him say this, it's like, wow, this is kind of a different character, looking at everything he had done before.
Right.
You know, good performances all around. Good solid performances all around. very interesting cameo by Han Solo.
Harrison Ford.
And it's not really a cameo. He does play a major role in the
storytelling.
He's
not who he is in 1974.
No.
He's just a guy who lands this role.
Yes.
That's it. And
yes.
In fact, he was a carpenter after that role until Star Wars.
Yes, he was.
So.
But I think it was a very interesting character that he plays and very similar in a lot of ways. In a lot of ways to
Han Solo.
Han Solo. In a whole lot of ways to Han Solo. So, I mean, he's got the fast car. He's a lady killer. It's funny to see that in that interesting way, Lucas typecast him.
Yeah, yeah.
I think in those respects, I don't know that there's really even a, kind of a smackdown moment in any of this. I think what you've got though. Is you've got a filmmaker, is you're seeing growth in a filmmaker.
Yeah.
You're seeing somebody who you know, is unapologetically a genre storyteller.
Yes.
And look at the stories that he has. Not talking the movies, the stories that he has told, not as a director, but as a storyteller. You've got THX 1138, the one that skips the track, is American Graffiti. It's not genre. It's not science fiction, fantasy, horror.
It's better than the rest of his films.
I wouldn't disagree.
The only
difference is and we can talk about this one later too. But then you've got Indiana Jones, the Indiana Jones movies, which were not science fiction, but they do have fantasy elements in them.
Right.
And they are adventure. They're very definitely serial adventure movies.
They are Humphrey Bogart,
I think
Treasure
they were...
of Sierra Madre films. All of them.
Yeah.
Really. I mean, they are, it really is kind of funny. There are a lot of scenes watching Casablanca actually a few years ago,
yeah.
where I thought, wow, Raiders of the Lost Ark stole this. Wow, Raiders of the Lost Ark stole this, you know, and Treasure of Sierra Madre and all of that.
Now, I don't know if you've ever read anything in depth about Raiders of the Lost Ark. I've got I've got a script book, and I had to bring it in to examine parts of it. The Indiana Jones character, now this could be a SmackDown moment. The Indiana Jones character is the way he was written. Is not nearly as nice a guy.
He's a dark character.
Oh boy, is he a dark character!
And there's a bit of a reference to that in Raiders, but it's toned down.
It's
the way Karen Allen treats him when he comes back.
Yes, because actually the age of the character that was cast, Karen Allen's a little bit older than the character is.
Right, and that
character is supposed
well,
to be that character is supposed to be about 19.
She says, I was a child, I was in love, it was wrong and you knew it. Which basically infers that she was complicit, but that she didn't know what she was doing. And Indiana Jones says, well, yeah, you did. But in apparently the original writing, didn't he rape her?
He didn't rape? Well, the original writing, and my math may be off, but I've got the script book and we can go back and look at it. She would have been, if you do the math, she would have been about 12 or 13.
Wow.
When this relationship took it. Maybe as old as 14. So it was kind of the idea that maybe her father and him worked together and, you know, they had something.
Right.
And it could have been not nearly as sinister as that. But what is a relationship to a 12 to 14 year old girl?
Oh my gosh!
You know, it's you know, sitting at a table with her for a half an hour and sharing a soda. Is that a relationship? Is that, you know, how much is that? Was he taking advantage of that situation? You know, it's hard to say what was actually going on there. But I mean, we've jumped farther off topic, but. Unapologetically, Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, definitely genre.
Yeah.
Willow, genre. Radioland Murders, not.
No, and neither is Apocalypse Now.
Right.
Which he conceived. I don't think he wrote the final screenplay. But
well,
he conceived the story.
I mean, that's arguable because you also have the book Heart of Darkness that you can go back to. So. I'd be interested in doing a little more research on that. I really haven't looked into that one so much. But, I think you've got some really interesting growth as a filmmaker. And you've got a guy that, in the midst of all of this, had created a universe that people just absolutely fell in love with in Star Wars. His later work has been a topic of much derision in the last three episodes, which, again, we've talked all that to death.
Right.
I'm really interested in seeing what he does now. He's
talking
about...
Tuskegee Airmen is the next film. He's going to do a film about the Tuskegee Airmen.
Another one?
Interesting.
Another film about... Because HBO did one quite
a few
years
ago. He's doing a film. It's called Red Something.
All right.
I don't know, but basically, he's apparently directing. That's what it says.
Well, I want to see what else he does.
And that source comes from IMDb, by the way, just in case anyone was curious. You can look it up.
I'm really curious to see where he goes. I think part of the problem with George Lucas and Star Wars, the last three episodes, is he was compelled. He had to finish them. He had to make episodes 1 through 3. You know, it was a big open question mark.
Right.
You know, he took the time. He led us to believe that there were going to be episodes 1 through 3. He made the conscious effort. He made the conscious choice to change the opening of Star Wars from just Star Wars to changing the name of the movie, change the opening sequence, later changing the packaging to say Star Wars Episode 4, A New Hope. It's not the way it originally was in the theaters the first time.
It was always going to be an episodic film, but it was not always going to be the piece of a sextet.
No.
I mean, it was always going to be, well, this is one episode of a Buck Rogers 12-week feature that you're not going to see. You're only seeing episode four.
But even that, I mean, I've watched those old Buck Rogers serials. The only one that had a real beginning was the first one. The only one that had a real ending was the last one. This movie was a complete work. Like I said last time, it's my number one choice of those movies because it is the one that told a complete story. Episode one did the same thing.
I think so, yeah.
Episode one did the same thing. It left a lot open.
I think with one, you're saying...
But by design. I think if episode four was the only movie in that series ever made, that would have not been a big deal. That would not have been a problem.
But I think this, you could make the same case with one. I think if one was, oh, this boy is the one, and they go through this deal and they save him and nothing else happens, you assume, okay, he carries on the prophecy and he's the one and everything's cool. I mean, that's the way it goes. And the beauty of episode one was that it was simply a story that takes place in that universe that is virtually untied to anything.
But you know what? He's already made that movie once. Willow.
Oh, he did, huh?
He made that movie once. He made the story of a child, a prophecy of a child changing the world. And, you know, are you familiar with Willow?
Not really.
Okay.
It came out in 85 and I was 4.
Okay.
And I've never seen it.
What you've got is a story of a magician and a rogue. I mean, I'm glossing over a lot of it. You got a magician, a rogue, a prophecy, a newborn baby. They have to get the baby from A to B. There's a wicked wizard, I think it was a witch, trying to go after the baby, yada, 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 blah, blah, blah. If you want it, fine film. Definitely see it. But this story has been told.
Well, the story was told in the Bible. I mean, it's always...
Well, yeah, absolutely.
You could tap that story
but
eternally for all
yes,
the time.
But to have the same filmmaker, the same storyteller telling the same story again, it would have... I don't think it would have rang quite
as... I think that happens more often than you would believe.
Well, no, I mean, it does. I mean...
I don't know. I enjoyed the Phantom Menace. Maybe
M. Night Shyamalan has made a career out of
the same
curveballs.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
I mean, his whole deal is all right. Story. Curveball. But if you were paying attention, maybe you picked up on it.
Right.
You know, the thing with it is that he pulled from Willow. In telling episode one.
Perhaps he did.
And you
that
know,
doesn't change, though, as a film.
No.
What kind of film it is.
No. No.
I think ultimately...
But to leave episode one in the same way that he left it, and Willow in the same way that they left it, I mean...
It's like the same film twice.
You have a story that ends when the baby is safe.
Right.
That was the end of the movie.
Right.
Now, that story, they actually did continue on. There's been some novels that continue on the story as the child grows up, much in the same way that episode 1, 2, and 3 were as the child grows up and develops, taking not necessarily the path that was intended. It was already done in those novels. So it's now definitely not nearly as dark in that respect. But... there are some very strong similarities there.
I see.
That I don't think can be really ignored.
I'll have to see Willow.
In that terms. But going back to pre-Star Wars, George Lucas. I don't have a SmackDown moment. I think his probably the strongest three films that he did as a director are THX 1138, American Graffiti, and Star Wars. I'm not going to call that Episode 4 A New Hope. Star Wars, the film that it was. I think as a director, I think those are his strongest three pieces.
I think, I mean, ultimately, you're right. He's only directed, though, six films. The only other films he's directed are these last three
episodes.
The other
Star Wars.
Of which I think only two is really bad.
And I think I don't know. I think he wanted to complete the story.
Right.
I think there was an internal compulsion to complete the story. I don't know how it would have been different if someone else had done it. But I'm really looking forward to seeing George Lucas doing something other than Star Wars.
I agree. When Episode 3 came out, my first reaction was, thank God, now
we
can see what else he was supposed to do.
We're finally done with this.
Yeah.
You know, I'm happy that it's over. Not that I wanted it to end per se, but I'm happy that I finally have closure and we can move on.
I almost feel like there should have only been one episode of Star Wars prior to 4, 5, and 6. And that if he could have somehow told 1 through 3 in one episode, you know, making only references to what happened in 1 and what happened in 2, and then telling 3, you know, it would have been far more effective. Although it probably would have been largely still destroyed by critical reception. Because Phantom Menace was just being set up to be destroyed with all the expectations.
Right.
And then 2 was so bad that when 3 came along, everyone was like, wow, this one's actually good.
Right.
You wonder if it would have just been one Star Wars film.
What's really interesting, what's great about the reviews is everybody's really leery of Episode 3. Day one reviews of Episode 3, great.
Right.
Finally, we're finally seeing some resolution to this. Well done. There's a lot of revisionist history going on now. First 3 sucked. Get rid of them. You know what? It's dead. It's a dead topic. You know, we'll still talk about it. If you want to call us and still give us your feedback on it, please do. 206-339-FBSD. 206-339-3273. Or fanboysmackdown@gmail.com.
I would also like to put one more question out there, and then we'll have to wrap it up.
All right, let's do it.
If the audience feels, as we do, I guess, basically you come to the consensus that everything you did before Star Wars, which is only two films, is superior to, you know, Star Wars the films. I think maybe as a concept,
I won't necessarily say that, because I will still lump Star Wars
in with the other two. Okay.
The first three films he's made versus the most recent three films that he's made.
Okay.
I'll throw it out that way.
Okay.
So let's go there with it. And let's throw that out.